Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. My name is Bill Meyer. I'll be the presiding judge this afternoon. And to my right is Justice Bonnie Sutterth, and my left, Justice Mark Pittman, will be your panel for this afternoon. Are the attorneys all present and ready? If you'll please call the case, we'll begin. Okay, counsel, are we ready?
We are, Your Honor.
Then please proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. This healthcare liability claim raises four issues for the court's consideration. First, did the trial court abuse its discretion in failing to dismiss the claim when the claimant never filed a report on causation authored by a medical doctor? The second point for consideration is whether a signature line with initials can constitute a CV for purposes of fulfilling the CV requirement under Chapter 74. The third, was a report or CV actually ever served in the case in compliance with Chapter 74? And finally, if there were no report, did the trial court abuse its discretion in failing to award the mandated statutory sanctions? The facts are brief and largely undisputed, although I think the parties would draw different implications from what happened. Pre-suit, counsel for the plaintiff or the claimant sent an email in the course of settlement discussions. Attached to that email, which said we will need to file suit if we can't get this resolved, was a document called a clinical case review. The email tagline itself does say report. The word CV is nowhere in the email or the attached document. Suit was filed. After 120 days expired, the appellant moved to dismiss on the grounds that are raised in the appeal. No report, no causation report, no CV, and sought statutory sanctions. And so we have today the issue of, did that clinical case review constitute a statutorily compliant expert report? The first and I think issue on which the court had the least discretion and probably did abuse its discretion is whether that clinical case review constituted a report on causation as required by the statute. 74.403A of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code sets out mandatory statutory qualifications for an expert who's going to opine on proximate cause.
Now, the parties seem to agree that Chapter 74 applies.
We do, Your Honor.
And so I don't take issue with that, except tell me how you hang your hat on this being a medical negligence case, since it does not involve a doctor.
This court actually decided that in Norgard LPC versus Pingell, in which this court evaluated whether, even though licensed professional counselors are not included in the definition of healthcare provider, an LPC is indeed, and the court held that the healthcare liability claims applied to licensed professional counselors. Three of your sister courts that I can find have come to the same conclusion: Fudge versus Wall out of Dallas, Skloss versus Perez out of Houston. And I thought there were three, perhaps there were
and
two.
And yet, in your appeal, you contend that a physician must testify as to the standard of care for a licensed professional counselor.
If I said that, I misspoke. The physician requirement under 74403 is a physician must opine on proximate cause.
Okay, so you limited it just to proximate cause.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. We do believe that if this were an LPC and that was demonstrated that the other statutory qualifications were met, that would be appropriate for standard of care. As for qualifications, 74403 says that a person must qualify on the issue of the causal relationship between the alleged departure from accepted standards of care and the injury or harm, and may do so only if the person opining is a physician. and the court goes on to evaluate a physician. It can be an MD, it can be a DO, you can be teaching, you can be in practice. There's a breadth, but nowhere in the statute or any case I can find interpreting it has a master's level licensed professional counselor been held to be a medical doctor to opine on proximate cause. And so here we have two different issues related to this document that was provided in terms of causation. First, the document itself does not talk about the causal link. This is definitely a point of debate among the appellant and the appellees, but on the very first page of the document, the author says, and I quote, "There is no way to review the harm and damage Ms. Villarreal may have enacted on the younger children." And the ability to draw from that the author is then going to opine on proximate cause is certainly a stretch. Even if the author, however, were intending to opine on proximate cause, under the statute, she cannot do so unless she is a medical doctor. Now, in this case, we wrap into the second point because no CV, of course, was ever served, but even taking her qualifications as they are set out in that signature line, it's clear, and I believe appellees concede, this lady is not a medical doctor so as to conform with the requirements of 74.403.
Riley.
Yes, sir.
I'd like it to be very clear on the record as to whether or not any further document purporting to be a report in compliance with the statutes, Chapter 74, was filed, other than this document that's marked Defendant's Exhibit 1 that's called Clinical Review Fowler-Castro versus Villarreal. And the date of this report says at the top that it's August 3rd, 2015.
No such document was filed.
No other document other than this document, which was the subject of the email exchange that occurred in the hearing and that was had on the 30th of September.
That's correct, Justice Meyer. One document was served pre-suit. Nothing was served in the 100-day period or at all during the time suit was filed. The issue of a 30-day extension was raised but not granted by the court. That clinical case review is the sole document that can form the basis of this court's inquiry into compliance with the statute for report and CV purposes.
So then, if I understand the record, it's fairly clear from the briefing that was done, the only item that purports to be anything in reference to a CV for this report is the signature line.
That's correct, Justice Meyer.
All right.
How much weight should we give to the statement made, in this case by the plaintiffs, that the previous counsel for your client said that they didn't need a CV, that they were very familiar with the qualifications of the person that drafted the document, the licensed professional counsel?
With due respect, none. The purpose of the CV is not to inform counsel of the qualifications. And there are a number of cases, UTMB versus Simmons, Pena, that we cite in our brief. The purpose of the CV is to allow the trial judge to act as gatekeeper. And so I have had many cases where I've known the qualifications. Perhaps it's an expert I've run into before, but the statute doesn't contemplate that I will need to be serving as gatekeeper. And so the record is devoid of any ability for Judge Cosby to have served as gatekeeper given that line in the CV. True, but unrelated to the statutory inquiry.
So what you're saying is that it's not the lack of a CV that gave rise to the need to dismiss. It's just that your position is the lack of the CV did not, the lack of a CV acted to prevent Judge Cosby from being able to perform his gatekeeper function.
That's a portion of it, but I would expand it a bit more, Justice Sutter. The CV is a statutory requirement. It's got to be there.
And there's nothing in the statute that says failure to serve a CV can result in a dismissal.
It does not, although the Pena versus Methodist Healthcare claim out of case out of San Antonio certainly intuits that that is indeed the case and, in fact, holds it. Because, for example, attorneys will sometimes write their Chapter 74 report trying to check all the boxes. It can be a complicated business. I'm going to write it. Until that report is signed by the expert and we have a CV, even if the wording is perfect within the four corners, without the CV attached to it, it is still no report. And I think if you look at an analogous...
Is it no report or is it insufficient?
It's no report because without the qualifications, it is no report. The words are meaningless unless spoken by a qualified expert, and that is true whether it says to standard of care and breach or proximate cause. My speaking the words, albeit perfectly, no report without the CV, and that is very much the holding in the Pena case. I think the Supreme Court has taken an analogous position in the Carreras versus Mariquin case when it was looking at marrying the notice of claim plus the authorization in order to determine whether a party is entitled to the 75-day tolling provision. And the Supreme Court says one without the other is not notice as contemplated by the statute. I think this is analogous. Why have a CV requirement if there is no penalty for the failure to provide it? Suddenly we have a meaningless requirement to produce a CV.
Well, if you throw in the fact that previous counsel said they didn't need a CV, why is this not a case where plaintiff's counsel ought to be given an opportunity to cure the deficiency? In other words, we have a previous representative of your client saying, look, I'm familiar with her, don't bother, it's fine. We get new counsel in. How come they shouldn't be given an opportunity to cure?
I think for a couple of reasons. First, there certainly is information in the record that that conversation was had with Mr. Norred. It's not reflected in any of the email transmissions or transactions. Number two, that's not the point of the CV requirement. It's not to educate counsel, and I don't think that the appellees can circumvent the intent or the face of the statute unless there is a written waiver. I think this idea that somehow there was a waiver pre-suit of a statutory right would require more than his saying that there was an oral waiver. And I don't think there's anything in the record that supports there was a knowing statutory waiver of the requirement to produce a CV so that the trial court could assess that. I think further that the CV requirement, because no CV was sent and no report on causation was filed by a medical doctor, this falls into American Transitional Care versus Palacios. It is no report. The objection is not that, oh, well, we can tell she sort of meets the statutory qualifications, UTMB versus Simmons. There's a paragraph describing the current practice. Here there's an entire absence of a CV. An American Transitional versus Palacios says the absence of a report, and I would argue by extension a CV as Pena did, does not allow the 30-day cure requirement. The court has to have made a finding that it was present but deficient. So I don't believe that the trial court would have had the discretion to do so. In terms of the CV and whether the signature block would constitute a CV, I will respectfully represent to the court, I can't find a single case that has so held.
Is that because the statute doesn't provide what the CV has to say?
That's probably part of it, and that's why the cases that have looked at the issue of what are we going to find to be a CV have tried to find a middle ground. We didn't want the hyper-technical, oh, the CV has to be a separate document, because if the intent is for the court to be the gatekeeper, including it within the confines of the report, gives the trial court what they need. And so every court that I've found has said, no, it doesn't have to be a separate document. However, when you look at those, The language in UTMB versus Simmons, which I believe we quote in our brief, goes on at some length where you can tell the requirements. I'm a physician. I'm licensed in Texas. I'm actively practicing. All of those boxes that we would be required under the statute. The most terse that I have been able to find comes from an unpublished opinion that is Laredo Medical Center versus Melendez, 2013, Westlaw 625-541. Even though it's not designated for publication, this is the shortest I've found any court has approved. The doctor stated in the report, I am a board-certified cardiothoracic surgeon who actively practices medicine in San Antonio, Texas. I am familiar with the standard of care for the evaluation and treatment of venous diseases as well as peripheral vascular diseases. That's a far cry from MALPCS. And I will say, having done this 30 years, I still don't know what the S is for. I know the LPC. I still can't find anything that gives us the S.
Ms. Farley, may I direct your attention to a different part of this report, and that is the part where the statement is made that the findings are limited only to the audio recordings, transcripts, and documents provided by Julia Fowler. That's on the very first paragraph on the first page. My concern is that there's nothing in this report that evidences any contact, direct contact, that was had with the children themselves or Ms. Fowler in terms of the formation of the opinions that are stated in this clinical review. She didn't have any contact with the children themselves, nor with Ms. Fowler, did she?
Are you talking about Ms. Villarreal or Ms. Michaels, the author of the report?
Author of the report.
Right. To my knowledge, she had none. The report does not tell us how the audio recordings were transmitted to her or what was involved in that. But within the four corners, it's a review of clinical records and audio recordings.
Thank you. Counsel.
Please the court. Good afternoon. Your Honor, today we're not asking the court to make any new law or read any new requirements into the law. We're not asking the court to judge the sufficiency of the report, and the reason we don't have to do that is because there is no objection lodged. We file a report, time goes by, case law allows us to file the report before the suit. We're not trying to hide the ball. It doesn't look like a treatise, it looks like a report. One can argue with whether or not the report is sufficient, and it's the job of opposing counsel to bring that up and say this is not a sufficient report.
Is there any evidence in the record where you told opposing counsel, here is my expert report?
It's on the email I delivered, and I think you probably see that in this. It's just a one line. Here's our report. We have to file a suit if we don't find an answer to this. But nowhere do I have in 24-point typeface where I said this is our Chapter 74 report.
Yeah, but do you ever say this is our Chapter 74 report? You say here's our report.
I did say here's our report in the email. And so
anyplace else that you clued them in that this was going to be your Chapter 74 report?
Nothing I could show the court. You know, I talked to Dr. Flynn. He's the one that originally got this. I think I even say this in the report. If you just look at the pleadings, it's pretty clear that Dr. Flynn, I don't think Dr. Flynn talked to the current counsel, and so they didn't recognize they had it. But they had it, and they had 20 days. And so to me, what's a little amusing here is for opposing counsel to say, I don't want a hyper-technical reading of this. Well, absolutely she wants a hyper-technical reading of this. She wants to say that, and then she wants to include other requirements. It is clear case law says that a counselor can be included in a case and be called a healthcare professional. What's not clear to me is whether or not you have to have an expert that doesn't exist. Medical doctors don't do this kind of counseling. It'd be very weird to say this is going to be like this. And so I think in the previous cases can be distinguished, and we're really not here to determine whether or not our expert was a physician. The long and the short of this is that we filed a report. The trial court judge looked at it and said, looks like a report to me. I think that this court's statement, made in Hart v. Wright, found on page 9 of our brief, the expert report must represent only a good faith effort to provide a fair summary of the expert's opinions. Need not marshal all of the plaintiff's proof, but must include the expert's opinion on each of the elements identified in the statute. It's a factual allegation. It's a set of evaluations. The trial court found that it was a good faith effort. The trial court found that the CV either was sufficient or it was not required. The statute is very clear. There are plenty of things in the law where we're required to do things, and the remedy is not you lose your case, a death penalty. So, you know, my request is we just look at the law and say, if you've got a problem with the report, you have some time. If you've got a problem with it, we'll have to respond to it then. That time passed, and the law is very clear. You waive all objections. So why are we here? We're here because they lost, of course. But
when did the time start running for them to object to the report?
At service.
Okay, not the time, not pre-suit when you sent it.
If it's pre-suit, then it's going to run from serve, from the time of service. And that the case law is on that, and that makes sense, right? You wouldn't say, I've got to respond to something, to a suit that hasn't been filed. I mean, I think that makes sense. But whether or not somebody's a physician, we're beyond that. Whether or not the CV is sufficient. And there's something that opposing counsel says a couple times that's just a flat-out wrong statement. At no point have we ever conceded we gave no CV. What we said is we gave no formal CV. I think everybody in here has it. Would send a different CV to the Lions Club if they're going to speak versus going to be ambassador to the United Nations. There are various levels of CV. We gave admittedly a very informal CV. But even if we had no CV, it doesn't matter. The law is very clear that Chapter 74 talks, 74.351 talks about why you dismiss. It's for lack of a report. It talks about report and CV in different places. And it says specifically, report. It doesn't talk about CV as far as a reason to dismiss. If we don't provide a CV, opposing counsel could say, hey, you've failed to do this, either send it to me, which is what all normal, sane attorneys would do, or they'd file something, motion to compel, or you've got to do this, or motion to strike for lack of a CV. There's lots of ways to deal with this besides saying, I'm sorry, you just lost your case. Really? Trial court didn't find that, and that's what we're here about, is whether or not the trial court abused discretion. If the trial court looked at this and said this is a good faith effort, the clock starts in service. 120 days go by where they file. They don't talk about in their motion to dismiss. Opposing counsel, the plaintiffs gave us a report, looks like a report, but it's insufficient and this is why. No, doesn't address it at all. Pretty clearly just decided or didn't know that they had it. So this is a harsh law.
All right.
So I'm happy to answer any questions.
On August 8th of 2015, was Shelby Michaels a licensed MD?
The answer to your question is no, but it's not required to be a licensed MD. I think the requirement is just be a physician.
Was she a licensed physician capable of making a medical report?
She's capable of doing this report, yes, sir.
No, sir, that's not what I ask you. The normal process in terms of doctor testifying in a medical malpractice case, trying to meet the requirements of a report, is for the person who's giving the report to be a licensed physician in the state of Texas. You agree with that?
Your Honor, I agree with that to a degree, but I would not say that it is appropriate, and we have argued this, and it is in our pleadings in the trial court, that Ms. Michaels was a physician. The word licensed is not part of the word physician. It's an adjective, right? And so the requirement as to whether you are a physician or not is dependent upon what's going on. A chiropractor is a physician, but it's not appropriate for other people, right? And so I'm not trying to skirt around the rules, but if we're going to say this is a healthcare claim that a physician must give testimony to, then where is the healthcare physician against whom that Ms. Michaels is supposed to be complaining? Is this counselor a healthcare physician? if we're going to, I'm okay with the courts deciding that we're going to come under Chapter 74 in some equitable fashion. I get that. But if we're going to say that a counselor has to have a licensed MD, then the counselor should be a licensed MD. The counselor's not a licensed MD. Is the licensed counselor a physician of sorts?
Okay, well,
not the same thing.
Let me ask you this question. Are you contending that the language that's in the Chapter 74 that talks about who qualifies as a person against whom a health claim, a health care claim would be filed, can be someone other than a physician?
I didn't say that, Your Honor. No, I'm saying.
No, I'm asking you that.
I'm not saying that.
Does the law say that you can file a claim, health care claim, under, and it would be a health care claim, against a person who's not a licensed physician?
I would say it has to be reciprocal. If we're going to say that the health care claim, Chapter 74, is going to protect counselors as though they're health care physicians, then the health care experts that are testifying onto them should also count as physicians.
Language in the statute says, or other health care provider.
However you want to do it. It should be mirrored. It just makes sense. And to do otherwise.
Your concern then is that if the person who is the subject, the defendant in the claim, is a counselor, then it's okay for a counselor to form a medical opinion and to provide a sufficient report in that case.
To the extent that the care being discussed is medical care, the other licensed counselor expert is just as much medical care as the care that's being given by the counselor. If one is medical care, then the other can be medical care. They were shoehorned under this in case law. If I'm not arguing with that, although I do in my pleadings, we may come back before this court on that issue, but we're not here today on whether or not she's a physician. Opposing counsel may want to talk about that, but all we're here about is whether or not Judge Cosby just abused his discretion whenever he denied a motion to dismiss when there's been no objections been filed. If opposing counsel wanted to say 14 days after she was served, your report's no good because there's not a physician, we have a different case altogether. But we don't have that. What we have is time went by, all objections were waived, period.
Where in this report that I'm specifically talking about the report that's from August the 3rd, August the 8th of 2015 by Ms. Shelby Michaels. Where in that report is there a discussion of specific medical harm that resulted from Ms. Villarreal's conduct? I'm not talking about conclusions or conclusive statements about this should have been done differently, or this was wrong in procedure or wrong in the method. I'm asking for you to show me or help me identify where there is a specific reference to harm.
In clerk's record, page 64, where you find this, there's a quote. I'm just going to quote, and this is from in my brief. It's also in the clerk's record. Throughout her sessions, Ms. Villarreal is so focused on reconciling father and daughter, she abandons all counseling theory, ethical practice, and research-based techniques. She blatantly ignores the psychological harms she is causing and allowing to happen in her sessions to a minor child. Also, later, two pages later, on page 66, there's and this, again, I'm just reading from page 4 of my brief. Not once in any of her sessions does she assess for suicidality, progression of depression, level of anxiety. Continuing on, as Mr. Castro later committed suicide with indications of planning and attempting to commit homicide to the younger two children, it is clear that Ms. Villarreal failed to adequately and appropriately assess this volatile situation, Even more importantly, Ms. Villarreal should have continued to assess anxiety levels and the effects sessions were having on his oldest daughter, as her anxiety can clearly be heard on the audio recordings.
Now, is your understanding also, the record, that there was never any personal visits or personal consultation, face-to-face meeting between any of these three children and Mrs. Fowler and the lady writing the report?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record. I happen to know that's not the case, but it's not in the record, and I would say it's irrelevant. If opposing counsel wanted to say that you can't do this without talking to the children, then that's a great place to go and have an objection. But I'll take you back to this court's words. This court's words. Good faith. Is this a good faith report or not? Is this a treatise that's unrelated? No, it's not. It's clearly a report by what I would call a physician for this case, sufficient under this chapter to meet the needs. We're trying to give the defendant an idea of why they're getting ready to get sued and what they did wrong. That's the whole purpose of this law. So why are we focused on, well, you didn't say that you made her cry right here and you didn't do it right. Sorry, we have a hyper-technical law that's should be fine. If we're going to have a hyper-technical law, then let's follow it hyper-technically. You have a due date. Make your objections or you waive them. Period. That's it.
Where in Mrs. Michael's report does she specifically discuss harm to any of the persons? Didn't do this procedure right. I'm not talking about should not have allowed this person in the room. I'm not talking about anything that relates to opinion on the part of Ms. Michaels about whether there was a compliance with some procedural approach. As I'm looking for, where in here is there a statement that says this was inappropriate and caused this harm?
Your Honor, if I'll just say this. If I have a report here that Jack was beating John with a hammer and John later died, I don't have to say, I think anybody, a reasonable person can say it's you can infer that the beating of the hammer did the damage. You don't have to say that. And again, it's irrelevant. It's a good faith effort, and if somebody has a problem with that, then they can object. But
well,
I think that if you just read this report.
For example, Mr. Norred, you had a death. And so the death was a consequence of conduct. And here we don't have that. There's nothing in this report that says these people suffered this mental harm, this mental anguish, this mental disruption in their lives because of the conduct of Ms. Villarreal.
Yeah, I think I just quoted one where she talks specifically about harm being done. And then there's another place that says the psychological and emotional damage Ms. Villarreal performed upon this family was particularly open on the oldest daughter. It's immense.
But you said there's no examination by Ms. Michaels of any of the people. She's just merely listening to recordings, looking at records. She's not having any kind of clinical approach. Our discussion with these folks that are the ones that are the alleged victims, rather that she's making conclusions from recordings and documents and then giving her opinion as to procedure.
I skipped over an important part here. The oldest daughter wore a recorder into these sessions. I personally have heard, and other people have listened, 9 hours or so of the actual events where you can hear Ms. Villarreal question the allegations of inappropriate behavior by her father. You can hear her. She's supposed to be doing reconciliation, and she is berating this young girl. It is horrible.
Isn't berating, Mr. Norred, an evaluation on the part of the listener or the observer of the recordings?
Your Honor, I'm an engineer, and if you say I'm going to put 10,000 amps through a 16-gauge wire, I'm going to tell you can't do that. If you tell me I'm going to put an amp and a half, I have to go look it up. Some things are obviously wrong, and I would say in this case, Any sane person can listen to these recordings and understand that this is over the top. This is bad voodoo. There's no way for me to accurately describe to you how horrible these recordings are. It is easy, Your Honor, to see that Ms. Fairline is over the top.
All right. Thank you for answering my questions. You went over line. If you would please, Clerk, add 4 minutes to the time for the response. Thank you for your presentation, sir.
There are three primary points that it sounds like could bear on some clarification. The first is this issue of waiver, that we somehow waived our right to object by not objecting within 21 days. I would direct the court to the statute whose clear language in 74403D says a pretrial objection to the qualifications of a witness under this section must be made not later than the later of the 21st day after the objecting party receives a copy of the witness's curriculum vitae or the 21st day after the date of the witness's deposition. In order to have waived objections to the qualification under the statute, one of two things had to happen. Either the witness was deposed, which never happened because of the Chapter 74 lockout on doing discovery till this expert witness issue is resolved, or until we were served with the CV. And so the Pena case looked at this exact factual situation and said, if you don't serve a CV, number one, you don't have a duty to start objecting until that 120-day lockout, because that's the latest time when permissibly a claimant could have served the CV. You don't have to every day call and say, hey, are you going to serve that CV so I can object? The 120 days is there for the claimant to use as they see fit. But because, in this case, as in Pena, a CV was never served, the duty to object did not arise until the 120th day, and I think we objected on about the 124th. This is not that case where it's 562 days before this comes up. It's within a week. Give the mail time to hit in case the CV is put in the mail certified, and then the objection is filed. So there wasn't a duty to object. Pena goes one step further and says the duty to object to the report as well does not arise unless there has been the commensurate serving of a CV. In this case, I don't know if you have to adopt that full holding of Pena, but that is the clear holding that there is no duty to object. So given that the claimant never filed a CV, we didn't waive any objection if you look at the clear language of the statute in 74403D. The triggering event didn't happen until 120 days passed. The second issue I think is important is what seems to be confusion on the part of appellees about the two different qualification standards for experts under Chapter 74. For experts who are going to opine on standard of care and breach, there is a separate statutory section, and he is right. That statute addresses his valid concern that if you are an LPC, it probably makes sense to have another LPC talk about your standard of care and whether you complied or deviated. But a separate part of the statute, 74403A, governs a different part of the Chapter 74 requirement, and that is on proximate cause. A physician, MD, DO, whatever, and the statute is explicit about what constitutes a doctor, and it's not an LPC, a doctor must give either the portion of the report on proximate cause or they can do it in a separate report. Why does that make sense? Physical therapists are healthcare providers. You couldn't really have a physical therapist giving a medical opinion on whether the way therapy was done medically resulted in a torn meniscus, a dislodged prosthesis. It's beyond the scope of their licensure and training. And so the legislature set up this dual scheme of to talk about essentially the boots on the ground part. Yes, we want you to have someone who is in that same specialty, and obviously much has been written on the breadth of who could be appropriate. But as to causation, there is no discretion. It must be a physician. And the concept that an LPC could be a physician for purposes of causation opinions in Chapter 74 is without support in the statute and is without support in any case law that, to my knowledge, has been published in Texas. You can't morph an LPC into a physician for purposes of meeting 74-403. At the end of the day, this is not any harsher of a remedy than results from the statute. This was a situation where, if there were any gotcha at all, we've got this amorphous question of what happened pre-suit. And I've stayed away from that fairly intentionally because I think it gives all of you the opportunity to make some difficult law on bad facts. But one thing that is clear from that, never was there a claim that what was served was a CV. And without a CV demonstrating that Shelby Michaels was a physician, there was no duty to object until 120 days. And the trial court didn't have the discretion to force an earlier deadline when there was no CV. The statute gives us that. And the trial court didn't have the discretion to say, I'm going to let an LPC be a medical doctor for this case. Judge Cosby is a wonderful judge, but respectfully, he didn't have the ability to rewrite the statutory requirements on qualifications or on triggering events to object, nor does the appellees in this case. And so we believe that the court appropriately would reverse and render judgment, that there was no expert report on causation by a qualified physician, that the CV was not sent and therefore did not trigger the duty to object until 120 days, and then whether the record is sufficient for the court to award the statutory sanctions based on the testimony that was before Judge Cosby, or whether it would be appropriate to remand to him for further consideration of statutory sanctions, I believe depends on the court's review of the record.
You suggest to us that we should just find the attorney's fees sufficient under the evidence that was presented if we agree with you that the trial court erred in not dismissing. But even the case you cite was a reverse and remand.
And I really think that's the appropriate. I would love to tell you I gave you a pristine record. I think the appropriate relief is reverse and remand to the court for further consideration so that a cleaner record is presented on the statutory sanctions issue.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, counsel. Thank you both for coming and being with us today and making your presentations. You've made us a very good presentation, and your case is submitted, and we'll be hearing from us.